Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And today, well, the first segment is a very local notion of politics, the Pacifica elections. We're, of course, under a mandate to discuss these things on our programming, and so I am going to do that. And helping us out will be Pacifica historian Matthew Lazar, author of a couple of books on this network, and I guess our official historian. And then after we speak with Matthew Lazar, we'll hear from Sam Gindin, who is a former economist with the Canadian Auto Workers, now teaching at York University in Toronto, and author of a very interesting piece on what's going on with the auto industry on a web publication called The Bullet, which is the e-bulletin of the Socialist Project in Canada. We can talk to Sam about the state of the auto industry, the piece called Lessons from the Humbling of General Motors. And then just after the half-hour mark, we'll be joined, hopefully in the studio, although there's a possibility he may have to call in, by Matt Taibbi, contributing editor of Rolling Stone and author of a piece in that magazine called The Great American Bubble Machine, a polemical but very accurate and well-sourced attack on Goldman Sachs, the bank that runs the world. All right. No time for the economic headlines today because we're required by Pacifica management to tell you all about our upcoming elections. Many of you have probably heard this all already, but I'm supposed to tell you again. This network is run democratically, they like to say, meaning that the local and national governing boards are elected by listeners and staff. I'm going to say a few words on all this and then bring on Matthew Lazar, the unofficial historian of this network, to put it all in perspective. Since this program runs on two Pacifica stations, WBAI in New York, where it originates on Thursday evenings, and KPFA in Berkeley, where it's broadcast on Saturday mornings, I'm going to keep this generic. If you'd like to run for your local board or nominate someone else to do so, you have to have the forms and signatures in by July 15th. If you'd like to vote as a listener, you must pay at least $25 to become a member, if you're not already, of one of the stations, or volunteer for a minimum of 3 hours, also all by July 15th. Ballots will be mailed out at the end of August and must be returned by October 14th. For more information on any of this, visit either station's website, wbai.org or kpfa.org, or call your local station. These boards aren't just advisory. In theory, they have the power to hire and fire the general manager and program director and set other major policies for station governance. So if you're interested in how these stations are run, think of running for the board, or at the very least, be sure to vote. Okay, we're now joined on the line by Matthew Lazar, who is the author of two books on Pacifica. Welcome to Behind the News, Matthew.
Nice to talk to you, Doug.
So I am a negligent radio host, and I do not have the titles of your book, so could you supply those for us?
The first one's called Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network, and the latest is called Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War. The last is kind of a history of the entire organization from start to finish. The first deals mostly with the early years of Pacifica Radio.
Okay, so how is Pacifica governed in those early years?
Well, in the early years, it was a staff-run. In the early years, there was only one radio station, Doug, and that was KPFA in Berkeley, which was founded in 1949. The Pacifica Foundation itself was registered with the state of California in 1946. KPFA was a staff-run collective started in 1949, and it more or less stayed that way through the early 1950s. It got a stronger board system in the later 1950s because Lewis Hill, the founder of Pacifica Radio and KPFA, became a little bit disenchanted with the staff-run collective business. But mostly, still the staff played a very, very important role in governance through the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Now, Hill's original vision was of a very broadcaster-producer-centered regime, wasn't it?
It was a very broadcaster-producer-centered regime. There was no listeners, the subscribers did not have any political power in the early years. And that was deliberate on Lewis Hill's part. He was after all, you should be remembered, he was someone who had taken a very unpopular position during the Second World War. That is to say that he and his friends were radical pacifists who had been conscientious objectors during the Second World War. Many of them had been in prison during the Second World War. It's a largely forgotten fact that about a fifth of all people in prison during the Second World War were, in fact, federal prison, were, in fact, conscientious objectors. He understood that the he had taken an extremely unpopular position and was suspicious of popular democracy. He didn't really think that popular democracy would protect radical ideas and freedom of speech. He saw how quickly the United States had gone from being very suspicious of getting involved in the war in Europe to basically becoming completely engulfed in it. And when the Second World War was over, he wanted radio stations that would promulgate pacifist ideas, but he understood that while everybody loves pacifists, they only love pacifists until there's a war. And then suddenly people become very suspicious of pacifists. So he was not a big fan of the idea of the subscribers voting in elections.
Okay, so then let's move on. Other stations joined the network. How was the place governed in the 60s and 70s?
Well, starting in the KPFA was 1949, and then KPFK in Los Angeles in 1959, and WBAI, which was already a radio station, joined the network in 1960. And then in 1970, Pacifica developed KPFT in Houston and WPFW in 1977, WPFW in Washington, D.C. After the late 1960s, the Public Broadcasting Act was passed, and there was a Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and CPB grants came with a requirement, which Pacifica began taking, came with the requirement that each station had a local advisory board. They had all had some kind of a board, but now they had formal local advisory boards through the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s. These were strictly advisory boards, which were part of the requirement for taking CPB money. Starting in the 1980s, after the final station joined the network, WPFW in Washington, D.C., Pacifica began getting more ambitious. It began, with the election of Ronald Reagan and with the left's preoccupation with media and the role of media in national politics, a lot of eyes began turning to the Pacifica radio network as a stronger alternative to corporate media and even to national public radio, which was overwhelming the Pacifica radio network by this point and really taking away a lot of listeners. A lot of ideas began floating around about centralizing the organization, making it more than the sum of its parts. It was a pretty decentralized organization in the early 1980s and such. And so you saw successive generations of people who came in and began experimenting with various ways of centralizing resources and stuff like that. And most of these were pretty well-meaning. And this accelerated in the 1990s with more national programming, a lot of experiments, which ultimately resulted in Democracy Now! Starting in 1996. But a lot of this came with a kind of a price tag to it. And that is that because Pacifica Radio is largely still, even with Corporation for Public Broadcasting money, a largely listener-subscriber, volunteer-based organization, there's only so much centralizing you can do without creating a lot of internal conflict and a lot of internal slack. And you began getting this kind of civil war between the largely volunteer-based stations and the national board, especially starting in the late 1990s with the Pat Scott administration.
The national board at this point was still, as they say, a self-perpetuating organization, right? They chose their successors.
Well, actually, that's not exactly true. The national board in the 1990s consisted of a board which consisted of delegates who came from the local advisory boards. There was a lot of dispute back and forth about this, but most of the people who came from the national board were, in fact, delegates from the local advisory boards. As Pacifica began more and more centralized in 1999, in February of 1999, in fact, the national board very controversially eliminated that, became a self-perpetuating board. And at this point, it took on a former Corporation Public Broadcasting operative named Lynn Chadwick as the executive director. She began firing people. She fired the general manager at KPFA, Nicole Sawaya, leading the staff there to think if there was a bloodbath coming. And there was a whole lot of conflict at the station. And in my opinion, Chadwick became more and more paranoid and frankly weird. And eventually she just shut the station down, basically causing this three-week riot, nonstop riot in the city of Berkeley. You really had to be here to see it. I saw it myself. There was, for 3 days, there was practically no police protection in the city of Berkeley and neighboring cities because there were so many police surrounding KPFA. There were people sitting in on the local freeway, on the nearby freeway. It was just quite amazing. And to make a long story short, ultimately what happened was is that the staffs of KPFA and the staff of WBAI, which also found itself facing the gun from the national board, allied themselves with listener activist groups that had always been very discontented with the direction that Pacifica had going, overthrew the old national board, forced them to sue for peace, and in 2002 and 2003, the listeners, for the first time in Pacifica history, got the right to vote in elections, and we got the system that we have now.
Was there a model for this? Who came up with this idea?
I'm sorry, was this who came up with the idea?
Yeah, was there a model it was based on, and who invented this this approach to governance of the network?
You know, that's a good question. Exactly where did the model come from? There are other radio stations and TV stations. There are some that also have been democratic. I believe you mentioned you wanted to ask me about KQED.
Yeah, I do want to get to that in a moment, yeah.
San Francisco. KQED in San Francisco was itself had a subscriber-elected board until 1996. There are other examples. San Diego has a community college radio station, which has an elected board. The Pacifica board, the experiment that's taking place now, I think, is pretty unique in the United States. I know of no other fairly sizable broadcasting network with 95,000 subscribers that is as democratized as Pacifica Radio is.
Well, as a long-term observer of Pacifica, how do you think it's working?
Well, so far, I don't think it's worked all that well. It's caused a tremendous amount of conflict and acrimony. I'm not sure I understand how it has improved the organization in any particular way. That is to say, I don't know whether getting rid of it is the solution. I'm not sure whether any other system would help Pacifica anymore, because there are a lot of other factors that are hurting Pacifica Radio at this point. The general problem of the state of over-the-air broadcasting and the enormous amount of revenue and attention that Web 2.0 has taken away from conventional broadcasting is a really big problem for Pacifica Radio and for everyone else. But thus far, I think the electoral process can be described as a pretty acrimonious and resource-draining experience for Pacifica Radio. I think that...
Resource-draining in both human and monetary terms, right?
Yes, people and money. Yeah, absolutely. I think that for me, the biggest concern that I have about the electoral process is that a lot of the expectation of people who run for the board is that they will have an influence, a direct influence on programming. That is to say that they will just be able to sit on the board and tell the stations you should program this way or you should program that way. And while I think it's appropriate for the boards to be able to have influence in terms of hiring, firing, general managers, strategic plans, labor relations, and budgets and such, the expectation that you sort of have this direct influence on programming, I think, is very unhealthy for independent journalism. I don't think that it is a good idea for programmers to feel, or for station managers to feel, that at any time they're going to be second-guessed by these boards. And also, there's always the risk of disgruntled ex-programmers running for the board, largely not because they really want to help the station, but because they want to get their jobs back, or they want to get their programming back, or because and various kinds of factional maneuvers can take place. So I think that that is probably the biggest concern that I have, the expectation that people think that they should basically run for the board so that they can directly influence programming.
All right, we've only got a minute or so left, but we did touch on the KQED question. They did have a similar governance structure and undid it a few years ago. Why and how?
Well, the why is an interesting question. The presenting reason that you read KQED flak say in the newspapers was that it costs too much. They estimated that it cost $250,000 a year, I believe, or it often cost $250,000 an election, which they argued could buy quite a lot of programming. They point the example that they often gave was is that the morning show that KQED had, run by Michael Krasny, cost about $250,000 for 6 months, and so that was a cost. There are some worries. One has some worries about the reform that KQED enacted, which is basically it got the voters to eliminate their right to vote on the board. They had an election in which the voters basically gave up their right to have elections. And, you know, there are some scandals that took place at KQED some years ago, most famously a program about the Mondavi Winery up in Northern California that was paid for by Mondavi. And that was a big concern. And I wonder where the checks and balances are to prevent things like that happening if you don't have some kind of formal listener-viewer process. But for better or worse, KQED did get rid of its board system around 2006. Excuse me.
All right, we have to bring it to an end there. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Matthew Lazar, who is the historian of the Pacifica Network, author of Pacifica Radio, Rise of Listener-Sponsored Radio, and Uneasy Listening, about the civil wars in the Pacifica earlier in this decade. Thanks for joining us, Matthew.
No problem, Doug. Thank you.
We will take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about autos.
I want to bite the hand that feeds me. I want to bite that hand so badly. Times ahead, but everybody else is overwhelmed by indifference and the promise of an early bed. You either shut up or get cut out. They don't want to hear about it. It's only inches on the reel to reel, and the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you feel. Radio is a sound salvation. Radio is cleaning up the nation. Say you better listen to the Bishop reason. Said they don't give you any choice cause they think that it's treason. So you had better do as you were told. You better listen to the radio.
And that was some of Elvis Costello singing Radio, Radio from sometime in the early 80s, I believe. And, of course, we now have, of course, the crisis in the auto industry, and particularly General Motors at death's door now, a ward of the state. We are joined in the line to help explain what the meaning of all this is by Sam Gindin, who is former advisor to the president of the Canadian Auto Workers Union, an economist who gave advice in the dismal science to the leadership of that union, and is now teaching political economy at York University in Toronto, and a frequent guest on Behind the News. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, Doug.
So let's start. You've got a piece in the online webzine, The Bullet, the Socialist Project in Canada, e-bulletin number 229, June 26, 2009. But let's start with the comparison of General Motors and Toyota that you you offer. People often say that Toyota does everything right and GM does everything wrong. Complicate that comparison for us.
Well, I don't want to take away from how inept and incompetent GM has, in fact, been over the years, and acknowledge that Toyota has had certain successes that it deserves credit for. But I think there's a whole history and structure behind this that has to be recognized. I mean, some of that goes back to how did it happen that the Japanese companies had the privilege of keeping their market closed while the U.S. opened up its market, and how did it happen that they kept U.S. foreign direct investment out but but got access to American technology, and how did it happen that they were able to freely invest through all of this in the U.S. market? And that raises larger questions about the kind of empire the American state was building after the war. And maybe we can come back to that. Maybe I'll turn just to some specific historical things just to highlight them. One of the points that I'm trying to emphasize is the fact that the Japanese moved into, and Toyota, moved into making small cars. It wasn't just because they were smart. It happened to be that since their base was in Japan, which had much lower incomes and much higher gas prices. They were building small cars. And in trying to get into the U.S. market, they just couldn't compete with the big three at higher levels. Where they could compete was at the low end. They didn't have the technology to compete at the high end, so they were coming in at that end. Now, at the same time, it should also be pointed out the big three weren't ready to make the kind of commitment to match the competition at that low end, not just because they weren't far-sighted in the sense they weren't, but it was more than that. It was that they actually saw building small cars in the 60s and 70s as competing with the larger cars that they were making, which had much more profit on it. So they saw this in terms of let the Japanese have the small end of the market, basically. If they get 15% or whatever, that's fine, and we'll keep making money on the big end. What they didn't realize is that having gotten in at that floor, the Japanese would be able to move up over time. So that's one element of it. Another element of it is that I think that Toyota has quite smartly played the environmental card. But what needs to be recognized about it is that, yes, they built the Prius, but like all other companies, if they saw money in making the big cars, they moved to that. They built a $1.3 billion plant in Texas to produce these heavy-duty Tundra pickups because they thought they could make money for it, and they were just as effective because that ended up having to be shelved. In China, there has actually been criticism of Toyota for trying to get to avoid the small cars and move into the larger cars like GM was doing. So Toyota's record in terms of the environmental stuff, like other corporations, it was a rather opportunist understanding that you could take advantage of the environment, but it wasn't about a commitment to the environment. And I think a third factor that has to really be raised when we're talking about this is Toyota's advantages. Well, I guess two factors. One is that Toyota's advantages in productivity is not just a question of being smarter and better managers. It also has to do with simply being able to squeeze workers more because the unions were smashed in Japan, and when they came to the United States, they were operating non-union plants. And the final thing that's also related to the question of labor is the crazy healthcare system that the U.S. has, actually, and this private welfare state that was developed in the U.S. Actually ended up undermining the GM and the rest of the auto industry over time. Because what it did is it burdened the American plants with enormous costs for their retiree healthcare especially, and the new Japanese plants coming in didn't have those costs. And I can elaborate on that a little bit if you like.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that in a moment. But you mentioned the genius of Japanese management, which was revered. We heard a lot about the genius of Japanese management in the 80s and 90s. But certainly the American companies have tried to emulate that. They've spent the last couple of decades trying to emulate that. Have they managed to adopt a lot of those techniques? And have they acquired some of that magic? Is it really all about being able to squeeze a non-union workforce harder than a unionized workforce?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to start with, it has to be recognized that a lot of the Japanese systems were actually American. They were rooted not in the American plants, but with American management gurus like Denning, who talked about quality management and just-in-time way back. And the Japanese actually adopted it and made him kind of an iconic hero in Japan. The Americans were never able to adopt that because it required the kind of flexibility that I think they couldn't impose on their workers. But in terms of strictly talking about competitiveness, the Japanese did develop these systems. Part of it was the flexibility they had in the workforce that required them to work and to squeeze the workers. And in terms of copying them, eventually the American companies have very much copied it. The joint venture with Toyota in California was very much, this is GM's joint venture with Toyota, was very much about bargaining with the Japanese about letting them into the American market, but under conditions that GM would learn from them. And they sent managers through them. And if you look at differences in quality and productivity today, they're pretty insignificant, you know, according to most studies. Right now, the differences are the legacy labor costs, and that's because they just kicked the shit out of the union in terms of productivity and pressure on speed up, et cetera. So the major costs really now through this crisis have been, A, that there's this crisis, B, that there are these legacy costs that I mentioned earlier, And there is this question of paying the price of having lost your reputation for building cars. It takes a long time to get that reputation back.
May I remind you, we're not allowed to use those words in American radio.
Okay.
Now, you say in your piece that, this wondrous Japanese management, you point out that we're talking about inhumane line speeds and discarding injured workers. Talk a bit about that. What is really behind that that productivity miracle?
You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on here, and obviously this ended up to be through the 80s and 90s all focused on workers. Like, you know, when the Japanese, you know, made their original breakthroughs in North America, part of it was that they were making small cars, but they also had an enormous exchange rate advantage through the early 80s, and that was when they made some of their big breakthroughs in cars. And this was used as a labor cost disadvantage rather than an exchange rate advantage, and was used to really start the first rounds of concessions. We visited the Toyota plant in California, and one of the things we found there when we were meeting with the union and the company, we were trying to figure out what was happening to all the workers who couldn't keep up with the speed on the line. And we couldn't get an answer for a long time. And it finally kind of evolved through discussions that they don't have them there anymore. That whereas in a unionized plant, somebody who's got an injury, we insist that they're actually accommodated. If they were injured on the job, the company owes them some accommodation in terms of trying to find work that they can do. The Japanese position was, they can't do the job. They're not working here anymore. And when you do those kinds of things, yes, you can be more competitive, but at a certain cost.
All right, so let's return to the issue of what are called legacy costs. This is the real difference of between the cost structures of the Japanese companies and the big three here in the U.S.
Yeah, right? I gave an example in the article. Maybe let me just repeat it. When you look at GM at the end of the 70s, before you know the big shakeout begins to happen, GM had about 470,000 hourly workers and 133,000 retirees and surviving spouses. When you fast forward to the bankruptcy, that 470,000 workers is cut back by 85%, not to 85% of the level, but cut back by 85% to about 64,000 hourly workers. While the number of retirees and surviving spouses increases by almost fourfold. It goes from 133,000 to 500,000. So where they had 3 retirees for 10 active workers back then, they now have 77. I mean, that's just for each 10 active workers. That's just stunning.
And that's absolutely unsustainable.
It's absolutely unsustainable. And it speaks to the limits of the private welfare state. You just can't. You know, and what also speaks to the limits of the private welfare state, of course, is that as long as workers could assume that GM could prosper and grow forever, well, yeah, you can carry these retirees. But if you're constantly downsizing, and then it's just a question of whether GM itself will survive, you don't have any insurance for your health care. That's why insurance has to be public. And plus, you end up being so isolated from everybody else when you try to defend yourself that you don't get much sympathy. So the importance of moving beyond that to national health care plans and decent pensions that everybody has is absolutely crucial, because the only way you can keep and defend and win publicly, you know, a decent pension plan for yourself. And the other part of this was that it's unsustainable in its own without even bringing the question of Toyota in. You just look at those numbers and you say, well, never mind Toyota. How would any company survive that? When you bring Toyota in and when you recognize that while GM alone has these 500,000 retirees and it's losing members, the Japanese transplants collectively, Toyota, Honda, Nissan, and Subaru, have less than 1,000 retirees. That's 1,000 versus 500,000. So you can see the different load that you're carrying. And, of course, that gets translated into competition, and that's the problem.
I should say I'm speaking with Sam Gindin, who is a former advisor to the president of the Canadian Auto Workers Union and now teaches political economy at York. This is WBAI in New York at 99.5 in your FM dial. My name is Doug Henwood, program Behind the News. And you, in your piece, say that the problem is not really the hollowing out of the American economy and a general narrative of decline. What's wrong with that analysis?
Well, if you take a look at what's happening in the U.S. In manufacturing, what you see is that manufacturing is actually growing. They're just able to do it with fewer workers, and the real issue is actually restructuring. And it makes a very big difference whether you see it as hollowing out, everything is going to China, for example, versus restructuring of the workplace and of working conditions and the geographic shifts within the United States and shifts between companies. Because when you look at it in terms of restructuring, you come to different kinds of conclusions. One of the conclusions is that, well, if they're just moving and plants are coming and going, there's new plants just at the same time we're having old plants, then it raises the question of unionization as a possibility, rather than just throwing your hands up in the air, because what can you do if everything's going to China? The other thing you recognize when you look at that is that, yes, you know, for workers experiencing this, it's horrific and they're losing their jobs and new jobs are in different places. But on a net basis in the United States, what you find is that the main factor in the lower jobs has actually been productivity improvements that workers haven't been able to share in. And that raises the question of, you know, the half a century of steady productivity improvements and very high productivity improvements and not having an impact on work time. So it raises the question of taking on the some point, the labor movement's going to have to take on the question of work time and reducing jobs in relatively decently paid sectors. So I think that's the second thing about it. The other thing is that when you think about it as restructuring, and this links up to the decline question, you begin to see decline. You begin to think about declinism differently. You can say, okay, maybe, on the one hand, maybe the auto industry is declining, and it's a crucial industry, but the auto industry isn't as important as it used to be in terms of technology and its impact, although still crucially important. But what you do begin to ask is, well, does the U.S. have the dynamic capacity to at the same time be expanding in other sectors? And when you look at that, you find that it does. It still is a leader in terms of computers and telecommunications and pharma products and biotechnology, and it's also a leader in all kinds of services that we don't normally talk about, but in terms of the imperial strength of the U.S. is crucial. It's importing an awful lot, but it's also foreign direct investment is expanding. It's penetrating other markets. Its capacity in terms of engineering, accounting, legal. You take a look at mergers and acquisitions. It's all still, even now, basically being done by U.S. companies. So the U.S. is still very powerful in those economic dimensions. And I suspect that after we're done with all of this, in spite of what's been happening in finance, the U.S. will still be the dominant financial player after it restructures and gets through this. So when you look at it that way, you don't see decline. And I should add to that that even in the auto industry, we're not seeing the disappearance of the auto industry. What we're seeing is a shift to the Japanese companies who had to come here so that they can get into the U.S. market. And they're increasingly, in fact, they won't match the job levels of GM, Ford, and Chrysler at all, but they're increasingly bringing more parts plants here, and they're starting to do more research and development here. So the industry itself isn't disappearing. It's not as if the Japanese could, in fact, simply ship here and produce from abroad. They've had to come here and also strengthen the American manufacturing base directly by coming here.
All right, we're just about out of time, but let me just ask the big question with a minute's space remaining. If we had a humane government, not one in the pocket of capital, now that GM is a ward of the state has a considerable degree of power in devising some way out of this morass for GM. If you were running things, how could we do it?
Yeah, I'd retire. No, I mean, the problem is when you see all this government involvement in the economy, rather than actually this being some kind of nationalization, you're almost seeing the privatization of the state in terms of how it's better able to serve private capital. And that's what we've seen in GM. I mean, it's been used to basically also smash the workers, which wasn't just GM, it was also the state. I mean, we just have to be honest about this, that until we build a kind of base, there's not going to be any humane government that can actually take on the power of capital and do nice things because there's no counter pressure. But the kind of things we should be fighting for is to recognize that as long as workers are trying to negotiate in this box of how much can we give up next time? How do we save our jobs? You just can't win. You have to stop thinking about saving the companies, but about saving productive capacities and saving communities. And we have to stop thinking just about the auto industry, but what can we actually do with these capacities? And that means having some kind of a national plan, because if you don't do it nationally, if you don't have some kind of a plan, it won't work, to expropriate plants that are closing, that they don't want, to say, look, they're still useful. How do we convert them to the kind of things we're going to need in the future? That's why you need a plan, because you can't just take them over. There's nothing to do with them. You have to have a plan of what they could be used for. And, you know, the environment is such an obvious alternative about a critical issue for the 21st century in which we're going to be converting everything about how we live, consume, travel, produce, what our homes are like, what factories are like, what the social infrastructure is like, what housing is going to be like, appliances. And, you know, that's what it would take to seriously address that. And if we're not addressing that, we're just kind of left with watching things slip away, workers desperately hanging on. So, you know, the notion that let's at least save the good jobs, not good jobs to save because manufacturing is stopping to be good jobs. We need to think larger.
All right. That's an aphorism to live by. Thanks for joining us, Sam Gindin. I've been speaking with Sam Gindin, who is a former advisor to the president of the Canadian Auto Workers Union, now teaching political economy at York University in Toronto. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to talk about Goldman Sachs.
But you can do something in between. Ooh. Baby, you can drive that car. Ooh. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive that car. And baby, I love you. Well, Danny told me that his prospects were good. I said, baby, got understood. For peanuts, that's all very fun. But I can show you a better time. You can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star, baby. Don't stop.
And that was some of Drive My Car, as performed by Christina. I think Christina Moray is her full name. I can't remember exactly. That from a collection called Mutant Disco, which was first released in 1981 and then re-released on CD in a much expanded version a few years ago. All right, we're now joined by Matt Taibbi, who is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone and author of a piece in that magazine that got a lot of attention and I think even caused some distress down at 85 Broad Street, The Great American Bubble Machine, a rather critical profile of Goldman Sachs. Welcome to Behind the News, Matt.
How's it going?
It's pretty good. How are you?
Good. Long time.
Yes, it has been a long time. Has Lloyd Blankfein got a contract out on you yet?
I don't know. If he does, he can afford it.
Yeah, sure. He can certainly afford it. As you point out in the piece, he got paid, what, three times as much last year as the Goldman paid the government in taxes?
That's right. Yeah, Goldman paid, what was it, a whopping $14 million last year in taxes total, and Blankfein got $50 million. So he was doing all right, I think, in the final analysis.
That was $14 million on what, $2 billion in profits?
Yeah, it was $2.2 billion in profits, and they paid a tax rate of 1% last year. And according to them, the reason for that was changes in their geographic profit distribution, which basically means that they shifted all their revenues to countries where the tax rates were low or non-existent, and managed somehow to avoid really paying any taxes at all, which is pretty cool from their point of view.
Yeah, well, they are masters at moving around money, and not just to avoid taxes, but these
right.
guys really are expert at moving money, and they have been for a long time. Well, your piece is kind of a historical look at Goldman Sachs starting in the 1920s when they were deeply involved in that great bubble. So what did they do in the 20s that made them infamous?
Well, they were instrumental in they didn't create these things called investment trusts. They were probably the most famous utilizers of this thing. An investment trust was basically a vehicle through which the ordinary person could, donate a few dollars here and there and put it in a giant pool, and some wizard investor like a PhD from Princeton or Harvard would take all of this pooled money and invest it in the stock market. It was sort of like an early form of a mutual fund, I guess. But what Goldman did is they kind of created this pyramid scheme, and it's immensely complicated, this whole situation. But they would create one investment trust and borrow against the money they had in that trust to create a new one, and then they would borrow money against that one to create a third one. And basically, they were borrowing money they were creating an enormous amount of leverage, and in the end they created these sort of gigantic financial organisms that blew up during the crash and lost about the equivalent of about $500 billion in modern money. So that it was a major contributing factor to the Great Depression.
But of course, all throughout that, Goldman was raking off fees.
Right, right. And they were also doing things like, you know, they would create these trusts and they would pump in an enormous amount of their own money early on in the game, which would drive the price of the trust up. And of course, you know, they knew that, and they would cash out early enough. And this was fine as long as they had a steady, you know, influx of new investors. You know, it's sort of the classic Ponzi pyramid scheme where everybody's making money until you run out of new people, new victims to claim. And that's kind of what happened in the end when they could no longer keep that last trust in the chain inflated. It all kind of, burst and everybody got massacred.
Of course, and then the masses get left holding the bag while Goldman Partners had bulging pockets.
Right, right. Well, yeah, until it all blew up. I think that the mistake they made back then is that they had too much of their own cash invested, you know, in those trusts. I think what happened later on, what happened in the modern era, was that they kind of perfected a way to use sort of a similar scheme, but they were able to do it without putting so much of themselves at risk, and that's kind of what we tried to talk about in the article.
But in the 60s and 70s, they were rather sober and had some sense of long-term profit. They didn't want to be so greedy. They were long-term greedy, but not short-term greedy.
That's right, yeah. Goldman had a reputation until really the early 90s of being actually quite a conservative bank. They, you know, their mantra, and they apparently lived according to this mantra, was long-term greedy, which, you know, meant that they were focusing on business opportunities that were going to make money in the long term. But, you know, there was a sea change in Wall Street, not just at Goldman Sachs around that time, but sort of across the whole street. And really, a lot of it started with when Salomon Brothers went public. And suddenly, you know, a lot of these investment banks were no longer betting with their partners' money. They were betting with their shareholders' money. And that allowed them to take a lot more risks. I mean, suddenly the game in town became how the individual banker could get the biggest bonus, as opposed to, you know, making money for the firm long term. And so I think Goldman was infected by that kind of change in thinking at that time.
So then Goldman was the heart of the major bubbles of the last decade or two, right? So let's start with the bubble of the 90s, the dot-com mania. What was Goldman's role in all that nonsense?
Well, one of the things that's important to remember is that until the mid-90s, you know, even leaving governmental regulation aside, investment banks had very strict industry standards. And Goldman was the king of the initial public offering. They were famous for taking Ford Motor Company public, among other things. And it used to be that an investment bank wouldn't take a company public unless it had existed for 5 years, it had to have been profitable for three, it had to be making money at the time of the IPO, and it had to be projected to make money in the near future. Well, what happened in the 90s was that suddenly banks like Goldman Sachs completely abandoned those standards, and they started taking companies that had, you know, only existed for 5 minutes, and had no profit history whatsoever and weren't projected to make money in the near future at all. And I think, you know, that was a major change in the way Wall Street did business, and that was, you know, what happened during the Internet years, that they took, you know, Goldman was the leading underwriter of Internet stocks. By the height of the boom, they were underwriting one out of every five Internet IPOs, and they were taking all these companies that had no history public. And a lot of investors were coming in, just as they had during the Depression with those trusts. They were coming in, and when the bubble was blowing up with these stocks, they were left holding the bag while the insiders cashed out on time. And
so Goldman didn't really have a lot of its own money at risk in this nonsense.
Well, sometimes they did. They did, but they knew when to get out. That was the important thing. And there were all these schemes that the banks like Goldman used to puff up a lot of these Internet stocks in the early going. Like, for instance, they had something called laddering, which was they would promise shares in a new Internet company at a very low price in exchange for a promise that, you know, the client who was getting those shares would come back in and invest again. So, for instance, they would tell a client, hey, well, we'll sell a whole bunch of shares to you at 16, but you got to come back in at 24 and reinvest a certain amount of money. that way, Goldman, if you did that, then the underwriter would know that the price was going to continue to go up at least until 24 or 25, and then all the insiders would cash out shortly after that, while everybody else would be left holding the bag.
Yeah, this is another illustration of that law on Wall Street, that it's not rising demand that creates rising prices, but rising prices that creates rising demand.
That's exactly right.
It's not
exactly.
Like your conventional goods or service market.
That's right.
The securities
right.
markets. Well, that all went bust, but then they were at the heart of the housing mania too, weren't they?
That's right. And again, the thing that triggers the housing problem is another drop in standards, just as, you know, the underwriting standards collapsed during the internet boom. This time it was mortgage underwriting. You know, again, it used to be that you couldn't get a house unless you could put 20% down, unless you had proper documentation, unless you had a job. You know, and you had some kind of proof that you were able to pay. Well, mortgage underwriters suddenly threw all those standards out the window, and they started lending to anybody and everybody in enormous quantities. And they wouldn't have done that, however, had not investment banks like Goldman invented a technique called securitization, which allowed, you know, these mortgage lenders to sell off these mortgages, these bad mortgages, to an investment bank like Goldman, which would then chop them up into little bits and sell them off as securities to unwitting institutional investors like pension funds and teachers' unions and foreign national banks and that sort of thing. Because without this process, of course, no local bank is going to lend a $1 million mortgage to some unemployed meth addict because he doesn't want to keep that mortgage on his books, but he will do it if he knows that he can sell that mortgage off to some teachers union in Holland that doesn't know what it is. And so that whole banks like Goldman were at the middle of this process. They were at the absolute key to all of this. And Goldman made money hand over fist doing this at the height of the boom. They were underwriting about 7 or 8% of the entire market during this period.
And the beauty of Goldman, or the genius of Goldman at this point, too, was that they were selling this stuff and betting against it at the same time.
That's right. That's right. Unlike banks like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch and many others, which were dumb enough to actually be swept up in a lot of these mortgage-based investments, Goldman actually knew that the stuff was deadly and that it was going to blow up. And they, as they were underwriting, you know, as they were selling these mortgages off to other people, they were betting against them at the same time. And at the height of the crisis in 2006, at the height of the boom, they made an enormous amount of money on mortgages, even though a lot of the mortgages that they sold blew up because they were alone sort of really among all the banks to sort of foresee that the stuff that they were trading in was so toxic.
They're nothing if not clever, these people.
That's Goldman. Right. That's right. And then, accuse them of not being smart, that's for sure.
One more bubble, and then I want to talk about their political power.
Sure.
The oil business.
Yeah, and this is something that a lot of people don't know about. I mean, I think you probably remember last summer when gas prices were skyrocketing. I mean, I was one of these people who was on the campaign trail listening to John McCain say that you know, we needed to immediately start drilling for oil off the Gulf of Mexico, and you know, Barack Obama meanwhile was saying we all had to start driving hybrid cars. Everybody assumed that the rise in gas prices last summer was connected to supply and demand, but in reality, supply was actually going up all last year, and demand was actually rising at a rate that was slower than supply. So prices should have been falling, but they instead skyrocketed. And why did that happen? Well, what happened was all these people who had been betting in the housing market were suddenly being encouraged by banks like Goldman Sachs to start investing in oil futures. And there was a so-called flight to commodities after everybody got massacred in the housing market. So people started buying up massive quantities of oil futures, and this artificially affected the price. By the height of the boom last summer, every barrel of oil that came to the United States was traded 27 times before it was actually consumed, and this artificially drove up the price of oil when, in fact, it should have been falling.
And we're seeing a mini replay of that right now.
That's right. That's right. In fact, you know, oil crude at the beginning of this year was selling at $30 a barrel. It's a very low price, but it's now up to I guess it's 76 or 77. It's more than doubled since the beginning of the year. And in fact, I talked to Congressman Bart Stupak a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying that, you know, oil has doubled this year, despite the fact that supply is at its highest point in 20 years and demand is at its lowest point in 10. So oil prices should have been plummeting, but again, instead they're rising. So it's kind of a repeat of what happened last year, although last year it went all the way up to 147, if you can imagine that. But
yeah, I think there was sometime last week when one rogue trader, and there are always rogue traders, put on some positions equal to half the daily output of Saudi Arabia, and in an hour drove up the price of crude by $2.50.
Right, and of course that doesn't, you know, there isn't a real consumption factor driving that kind of trade. This is purely a speculative trade.
And that was just one guy, not the mighty Goldman Sachs.
Right, exactly.
I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, who is a contributing editor of Rolling Stone and author of a piece in that magazine, The Great American Bubble Machine, the story of Goldman Sachs that the folks at 85 Broad Street don't want you to hear. The other side of Goldman Sachs, aside from their tremendous ability to make money, is their tremendous ability to work the political system.
Right.
Give us some idea of the scope of Goldman's involvement in politics.
Well, there's just the number of former Goldman employees who have occupied important posts in the government in the last two decades is just staggering. I mean, you have to start, of course, with the two very influential Treasury secretaries. There was Bob Rubin, who was Clinton's Treasury secretary, and then Hank Paulson, who was Bush's Treasury Secretary at the end of his term. Both of these guys were former chiefs of Goldman Sachs. But the list is just enormous. Right now, the chief of staff of Treasury is Mark Patterson, who was a former Goldman Sachs lobbyist, the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which oversees the oil commodities market, among other things, and credit derivatives. He's a former Goldman Sachs banker. Bush's chief of staff, Josh Bolton, was from Goldman. The head of the New York Fed, which regulates Goldman Sachs, is a former Goldman Sachs banker. The list just goes on and on and on. We could be here for another 10 minutes, but it's part of the culture at Goldman when these guys leave.
They call it an ethic of public service.
Of public service, that's right. When they leave the bank, they go into government, and they just have an extraordinary ability because of that to get the government to help them out in times of need. You know, and the great example of that last year was the AIG bailout when Goldman might have gone out of business had AIG just proceeded to an ordinary bankruptcy, but instead they managed to wrangle a taxpayer-funded bailout, which allowed Goldman to collect about $14 or $15 billion, immediately, and rescue themselves.
And the amazing thing is that we don't really know where this bailout money is going. But that bailout money, the AIG money you're talking about, but also all the trillions the Fed is guaranteeing, no one really knows where any of this stuff is going, right?
That's right. Yeah, there's actually an obscure provision of the Federal Reserve Act, which maintains that Congress does not actually have the right to audit a whole series of activities that the Fed might be involved in. And most of these new lending facilities that they've created and these new public programs, like the Public-Private Investment Program, like the SLP, and there's a whole alphabet soup of new Federal Reserve lending facilities that have been created that are just pumping money into the economy. Congress actually doesn't have the right to find out anything about where any of that money is going.
And we're just about out of time, but you have an arresting image in your piece in which you say we may be going down the drain, but Goldman is appointing itself something like toll keeper of that drain.
They are the drain. Yeah.
Is it really that dramatic?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people think, you know, when they hear about Goldman Sachs, they know their eyes glaze over. They think, well, I don't play the market. It doesn't affect me. But the reality is that, you know, these powerful investment banks and, you know, Goldman in particular are taking your money, whether you like it or not, and through a variety of unseen costs that most people don't even think about. I mean, you know, they were taking a percentage of every dollar that you spent on gas last summer. They're taking a percentage of your tax money. If you have money invested in a pension fund, if you're a state employee, they're probably managing your state pension fund. I know they're, you know, I live in the state of New Jersey. New Jersey has appointed Goldman to manage a lot of its state
pension. And its governor is a former Goldman Sachs.
And its governor is a former Goldman Sachs employee. The Goldman is everywhere. It's not not just this bank, but Morgan Stanley and others. But these banks have they exist in a kind of a gray area between public and private, and they're taking money in all sorts of ways that people aren't even conscious of, whether it's your pension, whether it's your mortgage, whether it's gas, whether it's your taxes. And people have to be aware of all these different ways. Otherwise, you know, they're going to be taken advantage of.
Yeah, it's a complicated system, but Goldman Sachs is the top of the heap. There's no doubt about that. And they deserve a lot of scrutiny. All right, I've been speaking with Matt Taibbi, who is a contributing editor of Rolling Stones and author of the piece in that magazine, The Great American Bubble Machine, a profile of Goldman Sachs. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this from Santigold, from a Diplo dub mix that came out last year, The Guns of Brooklyn, a version of The Clash. Okay, till next week. Bye.